You eat well, you work out, but did you know 99% of Americans are still mineral deficient? That's where Concentrace Daily Mineral Powder comes in. It's your daily foundation for better mood, natural energy, immune support, and nervous system balance. Formulated from nature and backed by science, it's a simple habit that makes a big impact. Because your body doesn't make minerals, and today's food and water don't supply enough, with Concentrace, you'll feel the difference. Go to TraceMinerals.com and start with minerals. Start with Concentrace. Feel off? Tired? Moody? You might be missing minerals because 99% of us are. Concentrace Daily Mineral Powder helps support energy, mood, and immunity from the inside out. Go to TraceMinerals.com and feel the difference minerals make.
I worked the same night Billy was murdered, across town, and I had talked to Billy on the phone about 5 o'clock. I think it was about five. He called me and asked me a question, something about some paperwork.
Wait, so you actually talked to Bill on that day while he was working?
Did you ever warrant your arrest for the murder of William Miller, who was the gas station attendant?
But you're wrong.
From NBI Studios, this is Truth and Justice, a crowdsourced investigation in real time. I'm Bob Ruff. Bill Little's murder is a complicated story to tell. It's riddled with twists and turns, and the goal line is constantly moving. Every time you think that you have it all figured out, you find out that someone who seemed like a reliable witness is telling a different story than they did 28 years ago. And sometimes, you even figure out that one of the police officers who investigated the case is currently serving a 440-year prison sentence for serial rape. In June of 2008, Officer Jeff Pilo was convicted of raping four women and stalking a fifth. You may recall Pilo's name from last week. He was the first officer on the scene on the night that Bill Little was murdered. Pilo's serial raping is a long and tragic story, but the nutshell is this. For years, he used his authority as a police officer to stalk his victims, attack them in their homes, brutally rape them, and then used his knowledge of forensic crime scene analysis to leave every scene void of any evidence that could connect him to his crimes, even going so far as to having his victims bathe themselves for hours after his assault, washing away any evidence, and leaving the scene with their bedsheets and anything else that may contain his DNA. Pilo was caught only because the one that got away, so to speak, caught him stalking outside of her house. He was discovered prowling around her house by a fellow Bloomington police officer. So what does this have to do with Bill's case? Well, probably nothing. But it's just another element of confusion. Can we really believe the statements from a man who spent years living a double life and brutally attacking innocent women? Well, I don't know the answer to that, which is precisely why we need to conduct our own investigation. A new investigation. And more to the point, a proper investigation. Are you with me?
Texas Ranger James Holland is a legendary interrogator. They call him the serial killer whisperer.
You can't hide those indications, and that's why yesterday I knew that you did it.
But now, shocking interrogation tapes reveal how the super cop really operates.
And that's why they asked me to come in, because I'm special.
From Something Else, The Marshall Project, and Sony Music Entertainment, this is Smokescreen. Just say you're sorry. Listen and follow on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Amazon Music, Stitcher, or wherever you get your podcasts.
A critical element of any investigation that is often overlooked is the study of what is known as victimology, especially when you have a crime scene like this one, with little to no physical evidence, no eyewitnesses, and no obvious leads. When the FBI is faced with investigating cases like this, cases where forensics are of little use, they shift their focus onto human behavior. The concept, while it may seem complicated, is actually just a great big dose of common sense. Every victim is chosen by a particular offender at a particular place at a particular time for a particular reason. If we can figure out that reason, why the victim was chosen at that place and time, it's like holding a mirror up to the offender. Every action is preceded by a decision. Sometimes it's conscious, and sometimes not. Nonetheless, there was a thought that led to the decision to take the life away of an innocent 18-year-old boy on Easter Sunday in 1991. We begin our investigation today by learning more about Bill Little. I want to know who he was, what he was like. Was he an aggressive person or more submissive? Would he be the kind of man who would fight a person over the contents of a cash register? Or would he just turn it over? In one circumstance, it's easy to see why he was shot, if he was fighting the offender over the money. But if he wasn't the kind of person who would fight over the cash, then there was another reason, another motivation for the offender to take his life so senselessly. How long did you know Bill?
Pretty much my whole life up until the murder. He went to school in Leroy with me, in our class, except for 2 years, I think it was, that he moved to Bloomington with his dad, and then he came back. Not having any interactions with him outside of school, to me, he always seemed kind of quiet, kind of kept to himself. I really didn't know him very well until our senior year. In our senior year, we had some art classes together, and our art room was big, long, 8-foot tables, and we sat across from each other the whole time. And he was hilarious. He was always yanking the teacher's chain, giving her a hard time. He was making everyone laugh, and he was very, very talented. He was a tremendous artist, and I really feel like he could have gone somewhere with that had he been allowed. I don't think he had one person who could say a mean thing about him or a bad thing about him. He was one of the good guys. After high school, I worked 4 jobs, saving money for college, and then I went off to college. I had come home for Easter, and later that week, my mother called me, and I did one of those teenage eye rolls. What does she want? I was just there. And she told me about what happened.
Valerie got to know Bill during his senior year of high school. She told me that he was kind of a class clown during art class, but he got away with the constant joking around because his work was amazing. He was a gifted artist. But Valerie also told me that I may be better served reaching out to some of Bill's guy friends, the guys that he spent most of his time with. Mike and Bill were very close throughout all of their high school years.
I lived in Bloomington my whole life. And then my freshman year of high school, my parents divorced. So we moved to Leroy, where I met Bill. Oh, man, he was larger than life, you know, and, you know, it was the 80s, you know, it was, 1986 when I met him. And he had that long hair that you see in the photo, you know, he loved his long, you know, it was the 80s. Everybody wanted to look like a heavy metal rocker, you know. I couldn't grow long hair because my hair gets curly, so I'd have an afro. So I always wore the Marine haircut, but, you know, he had, you know, just long hair. He was really tall, heart of gold. I mean, really good guy. He enjoyed listening to music, and he was always the peacemaker. You know, I mean, when you get a bunch of high school boys together, you know, it's all about competing, you know, girls or what be you. And, you know, so the inevitable arguments would pop up, and he was always quick to be a peacemaker, you know, to, hey guys, you know, come on, let go. And I always thought that was, you know, a rare breed in somebody, especially at that age. You know, most kids that age want to just go with the flow, but, you know, he always stood up and tried to make peace with others. He had a great sense of humor. He could dish it out as well as he could take it. So, yeah, he was definitely a smart aleck sometimes. It would get him in trouble with teachers. You know, they'd be like, Bill, come on. And, you know, we it was a small town, so we did party a little, but that really wasn't his thing, at least when I knew him. I mean, I would always want to go smoke a little pot or drink, and he would from time to time, but not a whole lot. It was a pretty wild time, you know. I mean, growing up in a small town, you know, Bill was one of those people that would want to go do something, you know, and whereas most people were content, you know, when you live in a small Illinois town, you can drink beer or watch the corn grow. But, you know, he had this ranchero, and it was his pride and joy. It was like baby blue colored, kind of like an El Camino, but it was a ranchero. And it was his pride and joy. He got it from his dad, and he'd always, let's drive up to Chicago. Let's go, you know, Peoria, whatever, you know, let's get out of this small podunk town for a day, you know. So he always loved driving that car. He'd never let anybody touch it either. Yeah. And to be honest with you, I mean, you know, me and Bill kind of went separate ways the last year before he died. And it wasn't that we didn't get along. We just, you know, met new friends, and I was hanging out more in Bloomington, and he was hanging out, you know, still more in Leroy. So when I found out he died, I was crushed, and, you know, I went to his funeral, but I really didn't know much about him the last year of his life.
This is a consistent theme with all of Bill's high school friends. He was an incredibly nice guy, funny, a peacemaker, and a hard worker. But after high school, he began running with a different crowd. Jacob, Valerie, and Mike all told me that after graduation, Bill started hanging out more with a guy named Danny Hartley, and they all kind of lost touch. It's starting to seem like if I really want to get a good understanding of Bill's personality and tendencies at the time of the murder, I need to talk to Danny. So far, I haven't been able to track him down. I did get a hold of Sean. She was one of the people with Danny on the night of the murder when he visited Bill at the gas station, but she declined to interview or even speak to me about Bill once she realized what I wanted to talk to her about. That particular roadblock is what it is for now, although I was able to get in touch with someone else. Someone who actually spoke to Bill during his shift at the Clark gas station that night. Chuck was working the same shift as Bill at another Clark station across town on the night that he was murdered.
91, I was 23, 24, working at Clark gas station, but I worked on the one on Main Street. I worked the same night Billy was murdered, across town, and I had talked to Billy on the phone about 5 o'clock. I think it was about 5. He had called me and asked me a question, something about some paperwork.
Wait, so you actually talked to Bill on that day while he was working?
It was like 5 o'clock. He had called me and asked me a question about some paperwork. There was something about some paperwork. I can't remember. It's been so long. It was. I know it had to do with Clark. You know, paperwork we always had to fill out, stuff like that.
And there was nothing significant about that call that you remember?
No, since January, he had called me. He'd always call me for questions, you know, questions about the register, questions about something, prices and gas. I don't know how to change something. You know, that's about all I knew of him, you know, and that was our whole conversation back and forth was. And it would last a few minutes because we're both working. We'd have customers. So.
Right. He seemed like a nice kid.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. Yep. Kind of reminded me of me, like, in those days, being I'm 4 years
While
old.
While Chuck doesn't know a lot about Bill personally, he does add some valuable insights into the operations at the Bloomington Clark stations, as well as some insights into what it's like to be robbed at one of those stations. 2 years after Bill was murdered, Chuck was held up while working a shift at another Clark station across town.
If we had like a rush hour, they liked it if we just did the $60 drops. But like after a 5 o'clock rush, like I worked there for 3 years and I always got my 5 o'clock rush because I worked either second or third shift. So I get that 5 o'clock rush and I'd usually have, you know, quite a few $100 in there, sometimes $500 or $600. And I wouldn't get a chance to drop it, but I'd have to take all that money, hurry up and count it in front of my customers, put it in a little envelope, turn around, drop it in the floor. And that night I didn't get a chance because he came back right after my rush. I didn't know I was going to get robbed. I knew something was bad because I even told the first shift guy I didn't feel right about working that store. I did not like that store, that or the Empire in Linden 1, because it was such a dark street. And at night, there's hardly anybody. I grew up in that neighborhood right there down the street from Linden. My aunt lived there. I grew up on State Street, which is about four blocks away. My grandparents, all my life, the high school and everything. And never was there a problem until that night with Bill Little.
Missing minerals? 99% of us are. Concentrace Daily Mineral Powder helps restore what your body's missing, naturally supporting mood, energy, and immunity. Get yours now at TraceMinerals.com.
It's important for us to identify a timeline of events on the night of the murder, along with our study of victimology. To quickly recap, Danny Martinez told police in 1999 that on Easter Sunday in 91, he was putting air in his tires at the Clark station, which was right next door to his house. When he was done filling the tire with air, he began walking into the station, heard what he thought was his car backfiring, turned back to his car, and then back towards the station, and then back to his car, and then again back towards the station. And at that point, he came face to face with a man fleeing the scene. But back in 1991, he told the police a similar story with one exception. In the 91 version of events, he didn't come face to face with the killer. Rather, he said that out of the corner of his eyes, he saw a man wearing a dark-colored baseball cap, a dark leather jacket, and blue jeans back out of the store and run around to the east side and towards an alley that ran behind the Clark building. In this original version, Martinez never came within 30 feet of the man fleeing the station. He only saw him at a glance. But according to Officer Pilo, neither of those stories can be true. Pilo witnessed Martinez going back and forth from his car to the gas station and had a clear view of the only entry door in the entire front side of the building, and he didn't see anyone in the parking lot except Martinez. Now, it's entirely possible that the officer didn't see the man running out of the door and quickly across the front of the building. We know from the dispatch tapes that Pilo was reading off Martinez's license plate number over the radio, which would indicate that he was focusing on the car to his right, and maybe he didn't catch the fleeing suspect to his left. However, I do not think that it's at all possible that he could have missed Martinez physically running into someone. Not only did he describe Martinez's movements exactly as Danny himself recounted them, but it's also safe to assume that the statement Martinez gave on that very night is likely more accurate than the one he made 8 years later, after police had already made an arrest and they needed an eyewitness. Taking into account Danny Martinez's original crime night statement, let's put a pin in that description that he provided. A man with a dark-colored baseball cap, a dark-colored leather jacket, and blue jeans fleeing the store at about 8:21 p.m. And then let's move on to the other witness that I mentioned last week, Gerardo Gutierrez. Gerardo Gutierrez, or Jerry, the name he prefers to go by, gave police a recorded statement in 1991, just like Martinez, 8 years after the incident. But before we get to that, let's first look at his original statements, one given on the night of Bill's murder and the next 3 days later. Keep in mind when you're listening to these statements, specifically the times mentioned, that police didn't have the register tape yet. They had no timeline and no suspects. At this point, they're just gathering information, and Gutierrez is trying to fill them in on everything that he knows. The circumstances are as follows. Gutierrez stopped by the station to put gas in his car. He went in to pay for the $3 he had pumped and noticed that Bill seemed very nervous. There was a strange man standing at the end of the counter. Not in front of the counter where customers normally stood to pay the clerk, but on the end, where the clerks would walk behind the counter. Later that night, he saw on the news that something had happened at the station, and he drove back down there to tell police what he had witnessed. What I'm about to read is the transcript of Gutierrez's interview from that night. Again, pay close attention to the times mentioned. Detective Crow asks, "What can you tell me about a shooting at the Clark station at Empire and Linden Streets last night?" Gutierrez, "I stopped at the gas station at about 8:05 p.m. and put $3 of gas in my car and went inside to pay the attendant. The attendant was not friendly like he usually is. This time he seemed nervous and upset and didn't say a word the whole time I was in there. He looked at me real strange, and when I handed him the money, he almost dropped it. There was another man in the station at this time, and he was standing at the end of the counter where you would go if you were going to go behind the counter where the attendant was standing." Detective Crow, "Can you describe this other man?" Gutierrez, Yes, he was a white male, about 23 or 24 years old, with shoulder-length, blondish-brownish hair. He had a mustache that was not thin or very thick, sort of medium, and he had what appeared to be 2 or 3 days' growth of facial hair, as if he hadn't shaved. He had about a 1-inch scar on the right side of his chin and was wearing a small gold ball earring in his left ear. He had on a black baseball cap with a logo on the front that was in yellow or white. He was wearing an army green t-shirt under a black motorcycle-type jacket. The jacket was waist-length with a belt at the bottom and shoulder tabs. The jacket zipped at the front and had a flap that folded over starting at the left shoulder area and went down towards the waist. The subject kept his hands in his pockets but took them out once to pull out a box of Marlboro cigarettes and light one up. The subject was wearing blue jeans, but I did not see his shoes. Neither one of them spoke while I was in the station, and I have seen the other guy before, but I can't remember where.
Crow.
What did you do after leaving the gas station?
Gutierrez.
I drove home and heard about the shooting on the radio, and I came back to the Clark station and talked to the police that was there.
On the night of the murder, just a couple hours later, the next morning actually, Jerry Gutierrez recalled that he had been to the station at 8:05 p.m., We know from the register tape that the first no sale was pressed at 8:06 p.m. Gutierrez says that he specifically pumped $3 in gas, but there is no $3 purchase on the tape. After reading this report, I'm now even more convinced that the first no sale was in fact Bill taking Jerry's money, hastily, because he was already in distress at that point. Let's couple Jerry Gutierrez's statement with Danny Martinez's. Jerry described the man as wearing a black baseball cap with a yellow or white logo. Danny told police that he saw a man fleeing wearing a dark baseball cap. Jerry noticed the man was wearing a black leather waist-length motorcycle jacket. The man that Danny saw was wearing a dark leather waist-length jacket. And both men described the person that they saw as wearing blue jeans. It seems pretty obvious at this point that the two witnesses saw the same man. But what's really interesting is the fact that they saw the man 15 minutes apart. It's hard to imagine a circumstance where an armed robber would linger in the station for over 15 minutes if their only motive was the money in the cash register. In Gutierrez's second statement, 4 days later, we get a little more clarification on some key details. I mentioned last week that Jerry told police that Bill seemed nervous. His hands were shaking, and he dropped Gutierrez's change. In reading this follow-up report, I see that that's true, but not in the way I thought it was true. Bill wasn't handing Jerry back change for his purchase. Gutierrez paid for his $3 in gas with $2 bills and 4 quarters. Exact change. Bill dropped, or almost dropped, the 4 quarters. The discrepancy may be minor, but it further supports the idea that the no-sale press was Bill taking Jerry's money. It was a quick transaction, exact change, in and out. And according to Chuck, the attendant from the other station across town, there is no plausible reason to press that button under these circumstances.
So was there ever a reason to press that no-sale button in a normal day?
No. We were told, well, yeah, there were some days of like... to either take money out or add money, or like you needed change, like your coins and stuff. You had to put coins in it. You hit the no sell button, put your coins in it and stuff like that. I know. And that's what I looked at my fiance about. She was listening. We had earphones on. We were at the dentist's office with our grandboys, but she was listening to it too. She looked at me and she was like, what? And I'm like, yeah, I mean, like last from what you say, 7:30 to 8 o'clock, he hit it 3 times. Why? And I've never done that in 3 years I worked there. I wouldn't hit it no more than once in a month, you know, or twice. And that's what I didn't understand. Unless somebody was like threatening him.
Was someone threatening Bill? That seems to very likely be the case. The evidence seems to indicate that Jerry Gutierrez actually stood face-to-face with Bill's killer just a few moments before the offender pulled the trigger. He further clarifies the times of his purchase in his second interview. He said that he knows that he was in the gas station around 8 because he went straight home after, and he remembers looking at the clock when he walked through the door. It was 8:12 p.m. he got a really good look at the man in the station with Bill. So Detective Crow had Jerry meet with a composite sketch artist. He created the composite that was spread throughout the Bloomington and Normal area in the days following Bill's murder. Gutierrez described a tall, thin man with a mustache, a scar on his chin, and a ball-bearing earring in his left ear. Currently, there is a man serving life in prison for Bill's murder who in no way fits Jerry's description. 8 years later, Gutierrez recorded an interview with the new detective on the case, Detective Dan Katz. Well, you'll notice in a lot of these later interviews, the ones recorded after police had zeroed in on their suspect, is that Katz seems to be guiding the witnesses away from any statements that don't fit with their theory of the case.
That I was there a little bit earlier, popping a little bit of gas, and I saw this person try again, kind of argue with her inside, and he was really kind of nervous, the curve. And it's just something, you know, I had a feeling that something was not right. I thought at first that was just a regular game with a friend or something like that. But absolutely, that's what I was thinking about that.
So you were at the gas station earlier that day. Is that correct?
That's correct.
Why were you there?
I was just pumping a little bit of gas to try to make what I was going.
How much gas?
Approximately about around $3.
After you went to the gas station, you put gas in your car.
Yeah.
You went inside to pay for gas. There's two people inside. Is that what you're saying?
Yeah.
One is the person that you knew was as being the clerk, right? You talked to him before?
Yeah, that's correct.
The other person, you ever see that person before?
No, never before.
Could you describe to me what that person was wearing?
Well, the person I'm at right now is just a tall person, brown. The person I remember right now, probably around 6 foot tall, 6'1", something like that, wearing a leather black coat, Harley, you know, jacket. And that's pretty much what I remember right now that he had on. I don't know where to become. I think he had a blue jean. And but I do remember before I walked past the place like that, I recall seeing his face from the angle that I was walking out the place. And the thing that I saw him, there was a skirt, right or left side of his face.
Now, when you see a scar...
Katz now is about to walk Jerry back away from the scar. It can't be a scar, because the man that he had arrested didn't have a scar on his chin. So now it becomes a fresh wound. Also in this portion of the interview, and I understand that it's a bit difficult to hear, but Gutierrez says that he's never seen the man in the station before. But in 1991, the day after the murder, he says that he did recognize him from somewhere. But he couldn't recall where. There's also no mention of the earring in this statement. Another interesting difference from one statement to the next. The man that's sitting in prison right now has never had his ears pierced, and therefore could not have been wearing an earring on the night Bill was killed. Back in 91, Gutierrez was certain about the time of his gas purchase, 8:05 p.m. But in this interview, as detectives and prosecutors are preparing for trial, the time shifts back to earlier in the evening.
Is this something that you just noticed, like it was a fresh cut or something?
Yeah, that was pretty fucked up.
So it was like a new
it's pretty much. Yeah, like a new injury. You can tell, you know, when it's an old injury, when it's kind of fresh injury, but... The way I describe that I saw that because I was not really far away from this person. I was just walking out the place. This place that are like real sure. Small. Yeah.
Now, when you were inside, I'm going to try and help you. These have been 9 years. When you walk in the door, there's a counter on your left. And that's where the attendant stood behind to take the money.
That's correct.
Where was this other person you saw? Where was he in relationship to the counter?
Yeah, he was kind of all pushed up to the end of the counter, to the, all the way to the inside.
So he was near the end of the counter, is that what you're saying?
Yeah, he was all the way kind of to the inside, the farthest inside he can stand.
Now, when you got there, when you put gas in your car, was there any other cars in the lot?
Honest, no, I don't really recall any other vehicle in the area. Okay.
So there's no cars in the lot. About what time was it that you put gas in your car?
Around 7 o'clock, around maybe right after, or probably a few minutes before, but around 7 o'clock.
Is there any reason why that sticks up in your mind, that around 7 o'clock time?
No, not specific. It's just the time that I recall that it was what it was. Nothing special. Nothing.
By this date, Gutierrez thinks that he was in the station around 7 p.m., with no anchor or significant event to pinpoint that time. And by the time trial rolled around, prosecutors used this uncertainty to actually push Jerry's gas purchase back until much earlier in the day, claiming that he must have been mistaken about the time because the only $3 gas purchase on the register tape occurred much earlier in the afternoon, well before the sun went down. There's another important detail in Gutierrez's interview. He says that there was no other vehicle in the parking lot when he encountered the strange man in the station. There was also no other cars in the parking lot when Danny Martinez was putting air in his tire or when Officer Pilo approached the scene. And Martinez saw the man fleeing the station on foot. Further evidence that Danny and Jerry likely saw the same man. So let's take another look at the timeline between the two events. Gutierrez witnessing the scarred man in the station with Bill, and Martinez's report of seeing a man exiting the station. There's a 15-minute gap between the two sightings, and the events that occurred during that time, blended with our assessment of Bill's victimology, should bring us a little closer to figuring out what happened that night, and hopefully lead us closer to figuring out who killed Bill Little. At 8:05 p.m., we have our last legitimate purchase on the register tape, $2.45 for a pack of cigarettes and a can of soda. Then, at 8:06, we see our first no sale. Now, there's a 60-second gap between those two events, and it's possible that the person who made the 8:05 purchase was gone by the time Gutierrez got there, but I doubt it. The no sale button was pressed at 8:06, and if that no sale was, as I've been theorizing, Jerry actually paying for his $3 in gas, that means that Jerry had been there for a few minutes before that. Remember, it's 1991 in the Midwest. A $3 gas purchase means that around 6 gallons of gas was pumped. And then Jerry had to walk into the station to hand Bill the money. Gutierrez had to have been there when that 8:05 purchase was made, which would seem to indicate that if the scarred man inside was Bill's killer, he had began his encounter with Little by actually making a purchase. Another oddity if the theory is that this was a simple robbery gone bad. What robber first pays for items and then holds up the store? 6 minutes pass by before we see the second no sale pressed on the register at 8:12. Then another no sale 3 minutes later at 8:15. And 60 seconds after that, the silent alarm button is pressed. So what's happening when Bill triggered that alarm? Had he already been shot at that point? Is that what triggered the offender to shoot him? It was no easy task to press that button, according to Chuck. He actually considered doing so when he was robbed in 1993.
At the store I worked at, yes. I don't know about that one on Linden and Empire. He must have had easy access to it. But the one on Main Street that I worked on, I couldn't reach it. It was like the register. Picture the counter and you got the register and I'm standing in front of it. If I were to just reach down and touch it, it wasn't there. You had to reach a good maybe 2 foot away, foot away maybe.
So you couldn't really just nonchalantly reach down and push it?
No, because he would have attacked me at that time.
Mm-hmm. What did they teach you about as far as like if you were robbed, did they tell you to try to keep the money back, or did they tell you just give them the money, hit the alarm? Did they train you on that at all?
It wasn't real no training. They just said hit the robbery button and just keep your register with not a lot of money in it.
It seems like Bill would have had to make a pretty deliberate movement in order to trigger the alarm. But I don't think the evidence in its entirety is telling us that Bill was shot either before or as a result of him hitting the alarm. By the time he pressed the button, the no-sale button had been pressed twice. One of those times in the minute just before the alert was sent out. I think that Bill may have taken advantage of the offender being distracted in that moment to raise the alarm. By that point, the man Gutierrez had described had been in the station for at least 10 minutes. And it was another 5 minutes before Martinez heard what he believed to be backfires from his car. I think that it is entirely plausible to consider that Bill was actually shot while Officer Pilo was across the street. And it could have been the sound of the approaching sirens that caused the offender to fire his gun. So the question we have to ask ourselves takes us right back to victimology. If Gutierrez and Martinez saw the same man, then why did that man spend 15 minutes in the station with Bill before he killed him? Or at least, why did he spend 10 minutes in there before getting the money out of the drawer? What was Bill doing during that time? If we believe Gutierrez, then Bill was not only very nervous, but was also cooperating with his attacker. Jerry said that Bill never said a word and didn't make any attempt to indicate that he was being threatened. So why didn't the offender just take the money and leave at, say, 8:07? Would Bill have fought for the money in the register?
I mean, I can't imagine anybody would want to single out Bill to hurt him, because Bill was such a great guy to be around. I mean, he really was. I mean, we were friends, so we argued from time to time about small stuff, but, you know, never anything serious. He would always diffuse the situation instead of escalating it, you know. That's the way he was in high school. You know, me and him got a job together because our grades were somewhat good. My junior year, I believe it was, or it might've been my senior year, but we got into this program where we could take off 2 hours early from school and go work at this truck stop in Bloomington. And so we really got close then, because we, you know, went to school and then worked together. It's a restaurant, you know. People complain about this, that, and the other, and Bill was always fast to diffuse when a waitress gets mad or whatever, you know, or for an unruly customer. You know, he was just, he could get you to smile. You know, he was good that way.
That's the thing that puzzles me about the crime scene is, from what I'm hearing, and you might have a little better insight into it, he seems like the kind of guy that, you know, someone's holding him up and pointing a gun at him, taking the money, that he would, you know, he might try to calm him down and then would give him. I can't see him fighting for the gas station's money.
No, me either. And I heard it was only like $40 they got.
Yeah, I think it was like $97 or something.
Okay, so it was a little bit more. But yeah, I mean, I wasn't there, so I don't know for sure. But I honestly can't believe that Bill would try to fight for the gas station's money. He would have just said, here you go, man, you know.
Right. And that's what makes me feel like there's got to be more going on there. I mean, if somebody's, you know, robbing a gas station for $90, do they then turn around and commit a murder?
No, especially in Bloomington. I mean, there was one famous murder before this. He killed his whole family. You know, I think that was the only other major crime Bloomington had like this. And at least, you know, the Hendricks murder had somewhat of a motive. You know, he was cheating on his wife or something like that, if I remember right, and trying to cover his tracks. But yeah, Bill, it's just a senseless murder. I can't for the wife. I mean, I didn't know Bill in the last year of his life that well, so I can't say who he was hanging out with. So, I mean, if that's where you're kind of going with this, I mean, you may want to try and find someone who knew him a little better in the last year of his life, because the Bill I knew wouldn't have gotten into a confrontation over $90.
1990 High School Bill, Future Farmers of America Bill, wouldn't have fought an armed man over $90 of the gas station's money. But things may have changed in the years following graduation. Bill left most of his high school friends behind and started hanging out with a new crowd. I need to talk to Bill's new friends to better understand his victimology. I need to find Danny Hartley. Truth and Justice is an NBI Studios production and is distributed by Wondery. Mike Bussing is our executive producer and Shane Yoder is our sound engineer. All music for the show is created, composed, and scored by PutThemInASong.com, who also mixed and mastered this episode. Our Season 7 logo was created by me, with assistance from Zach Weaver and Shane Yoder. All of our font across all of our logos and banners was created by Tate Krupa of Red Swan Graphic Design. You can find more of Tate's work on Etsy. Thank you to Katie Ross of CreatedInTandem.com for designing, creating, managing, and maintaining our website, Truth and Justice Pod, where you can view all photos and documents discussed in every episode. Thank you to our transcription team, Natalie Alicia, Pamela Westby, Pam Maples, and Jen Reese Incandela. And as always, thank you to all of you for all of your engagement and support. If you like the show and you'd like to support us, you can do so in a number of ways. To financially support the show, you can go to patreon.com/truthandjustice. On the Patreon page, you can pledge as little as $3 a month, and we also have reward levels on Patreon that include access to behind-the-scenes videos of the tapings of our Friday follow-up episodes, ad-free versions of all of our episodes, Truth and Justice Army t-shirts and hats, and even the opportunity to co-host one of our Friday follow-up episodes. You can also help us out by going to iTunes and leaving us a 5-star rating and review. And lastly, you can always support us by supporting the companies that sponsor this program. If you have a new case that you'd like us to consider for future seasons, you can submit your cases on our website, truthandjusticepod.com. Just click on the case submission button and fill out the form. And the most important thing that you can do is engage in the investigations. You can keep in touch with us through our email at theories@truthandjusticepod.com, or you can like our Facebook page or join in on the conversation on the Truth and Justice Podcast fans page. And for all of you tweeters, you can connect with us on Twitter. The show's handle is @TruthJusticePod, and my personal Twitter handle is @BobRuffTruth. And you can even follow Mike at MBussing89. For more personal interactions, feel free to follow me on Instagram @TruthJusticePod. And don't forget that we always have our 24/7 voicemail line open for questions, comments, and tips on our cases. That phone number is 269-224-2833. However you do it, stay engaged, stay in touch. But as for now, I'm signing off. I'm Bob Ruff, and this has been Truth and Justice.
I wear a few different hats as a CFO. You know, sometimes it's referred to as chief fixing officer. Wherever there's a fire in the business, you know, I'm often there first.
Whatever hat CFOs like Imran need to wear, Sage's tools and insights can make sure they fit. Sage, helping business flow.